Hello and welcome to Behind the News. My name is Doug Henwood. Two segments today, no surprise there. First, Brian Hugh will explain what got 2 million people into the streets of Hong Kong. And at the bottom of the hour, Ashley Sanders will analyze climate grief. Pictures coming out of Hong Kong have been stunning. Last Sunday, there were 2 million people in the streets, over a quarter the jurisdiction's population of almost 7.5 million. I said jurisdiction because the Hong Kong Special Administrative Region of the People's Republic of China, its official name, takes up a dozen words. The spark was a proposed new law that would allow for the extradition of criminal suspects to China and Taiwan, but as we'll hear, the demonstrations are about far more than that. Hong Kong became a British colony in 1842. It soon became a major trading hub, and the British footprint expanded towards the end of the 19th century. In 1898, the colonizer got a 99-year lease to the so-called New Territories, one of the three regions of Hong Kong. Over the next century, Hong Kong became first a major manufacturing zone and then evolved into a major shipping and financial center. But that 99-year lease was coming close to expiration, and in 1997, it was handed over to China. Although officially part of China, Hong Kong retains a degree of autonomy. Chinese law doesn't apply, and British common law remains an important influence. Hong Kong raises its own revenue and issues its own passports. The head of government is known, appropriately enough for such a business-driven place, as a chief executive. The current occupant of that office is Carrie Lam. She's the one who issued the proposed extradition law, though it's unlikely she'd have done so without Beijing's approval. So why are 2 million people protesting an extradition law? What else is at stake? Here's Brian Hugh, that's spelled H-I-O-E, with some answers. He's one of the founding editors of New Bloom, which, in its own words, is an online magazine featuring radical perspectives on Taiwan and the Asia-Pacific. Hugh is an American of Taiwanese origin who grew up and was educated in New York. He's now living in Taiwan. Brian Hugh.
The proximate cause of these demonstrations was the attempt to extradite a guy who was accused of murdering his girlfriend in Taiwan, right? And he ran away to Hong Kong to escape the police, right?
Yeah, that's right. And so because he's, it's a Hong Kong man that murdered his girlfriend. They're both like around college age. And the issue is that Hong Kong doesn't have an extradition treaty with Taiwan, nor with, I think, the majority of the world's countries. And therefore, you know, this raises issue of what do you do then? Like, how do you extradite people who have committed crimes in other territories or countries that are residents of Hong Kong? And so then, you know, the notion was to sign this kind of to create an extradition law, which would potentially allow, you know, Hong Kong citizens to also be deported to China to face charges. I mean, you know, you could always just have this kind of case-by-case thing where you just actually handle this case with Taiwan, or you just sign a kind of more specific extradition treaty with Taiwan. But the Hong Kong government kind of saw as an opportunity to pass this law, which would restrict the political freedoms of Hong Kong residents.
Yeah, because in the face of it, you know, you'd say, what's wrong with extraditing a guy accused of murder? I mean, that seems like pretty normal stuff, but it obviously touched a nerve beyond that.
Yeah, that's right. And there's also past cases in which, for example, a Hong Kong resident has committed crimes in Taiwan, actually, and also in other places. And there hasn't been this kind of, you know, need to pass this big law in which, you know, potentially you could have people that are political dissidents in Hong Kong or critics of the government in Hong Kong being deported to China. And so it was just kind of using this case, I think, as a convenient way to, you know, restrict political freedoms further, create this measure which would allow just for the open deportation of Hong Kong residents to China.
And I read one account that said that business people who are in trouble now because of the U.S. trade war are running away from financial troubles by going to Hong Kong and trying to escape the reach of the Chinese authorities. How important is that?
Yeah, I think it's one of the very interesting things, and maybe that is why there has been a large response that, you know, there's this panic from the elite, or the bourgeoisie, as you could put it. Like, Hong Kong is one of the big financial centers of Asia, along with Singapore. And so with this concern that, particularly, I think people that work in finance in China sometimes are a little scared that even if they just, for example, report accurately on financial information about China, that then they could be, you know, come under scrutiny or charges because, you know, China sometimes doesn't want the complete picture of its economy being so clear. Then what about these people in Hong Kong then? They also have this concern that then China could potentially come after them in Hong Kong, and so Hong Kong is not a safe place anymore. A lot of indications are that they would try to move to Singapore.
It seems like the Chinese government is quite skilled at finding charges to get their enemies in trouble with, right?
That's right. Yeah, I think so. I mean, just, you know, lobbying kind of flexible thing at the determined by the government. I think just that the Chinese government can always find something. And so in this case, I think it's interesting that the extradition treaty was one of a possible, it's one of many things that could have set off protests, but it happened to be this extradition treaty.
But this, of course, is sort of a symbol of the entire Hong Kong-China relation, right? That is that what's getting 2 million people out in the streets?
Yeah, that's right. And what is interesting is that I think part of the reason why is, you know, Hong Kong is already a place in which candidates can be prevented from running for office if Beijing doesn't like their political views. If you win running for office, you know, win the election, you can still be disqualified from actually entering, for example, the legislature because Beijing doesn't really like your political views. And Beijing could still jail you even if you're a legislator. Or they could send, you know, mobs to physically attack you in the streets. So Hong Kong has already become a place like this. But this law in particular is concerning because Beijing was already kidnapping residents of Hong Kong to have them reappear in the Chinese mainland and to confess the, you know, crimes. And these are probably forced confessions, you know, saying that, oh, I killed somebody and so I went to China of my own free will when actually you were kidnapped from within Hong Kong by the Chinese government. Now, this happened to a group of booksellers that were publishing books critical of the Chinese government. And the issue with this extradition treaty is that while this was already happening under the table, clandestinely, this would just make it very open. The government would do this openly and, you know, just send you to China to face charges under any trumped up, whatever they claim.
Now, what about the relation between Hong Kong and China? Hong Kong does have some degree of civil liberties, right, that are greater than what is enjoyed in China?
Yeah, but that's deteriorating quite fast. So the agreement under the handover from Hong Kong from British control to Chinese control was that the system would not be changed for 50 years. It would not be changed until 2047. But of course, you know, once the 1997 handover happened, political freedom became deteriorating much faster. And for example, that's why in 2003 you had these massive protests, which are the kind of predecessor of these protests in many ways, just against Article 23, which would criminalize treason against the government. And the fear was that this would be used by the Chinese government to arrest Hong Kongers for criticizing the Chinese government. You had the further deterioration of freedoms under Xi Jinping when he took power in 2012. And so, you know, you've seen the worsening of the situation in Hong Kong and China, and they're kind of bound together. You know, previously China looked like it was getting better in some periods in the 2000s in terms of opening up politically in terms of freedoms. And that changed really rapidly under Xi Jinping. So the part of the concern is that, you know, Hong Kong will just become similar to any other Chinese city. In terms of freedoms and the restrictions on freedoms that exist.
Now, Hong Kong society, it's one of the most unequal in the world, right?
That's right. Yeah, it is one of the most unequal. Yeah, people literally living in cages. That is also one of the things I think that's a triggering factor behind these protests, particularly when young people are motivated to go to the streets. That, you know, one of the underlying factors is the lack of opportunities and the inability of the Hong Kong government to take any measures or unwillingness to take any measures to provide for them. It's much more interested in catering to this kind of elite, oftentimes, which are, you know, coming in from China sometimes. I mean, these kind of elite that jump around between, say, Hong Kong, China, and other places.
It seems that some of the young people I've seen quoted in Hong Kong have complaints very similar to what young people around the world are saying, that they have no economic future, the prospects are dismal, and they're lost and desperate.
I think that's right. I think that's one of the issues there, that low salaries, lack of opportunities, no ability to afford housing. You have people living in incredibly tiny housing, these tiny, tiny apartment blocks. Hong Kong, again, it is a city that is dominated by its financial elite, and that has not changed in the history of Hong Kong. And it's also worth noting that Hong Kong also was actually never really democratic, despite the claim of a lot of these young activists to, you know, be defending democracy. The British introduced democracy late to Hong Kong. And also just the current government system, it actually directly allows corporate interests to have a seat on the legislature in the form of what are referred to as financial constituencies, these being seats that represent, you know, financial, a different industrial interests or commercial interest in different fields like architecture or, you know, so forth.
They should do that in the U.S. House of Representatives, I guess, but
it'd be
more explicit
honest
about it.
Yeah, exactly.
What are people asking for? I mean, there's that great kind of floating signifier, empty signifier of democracy, but what precisely do people want? The people are in the streets. What are they looking for?
Yeah, and I think that's one of the big opaque questions, but it also one way in which this extradition bill, it's one issue that points to a host of different issues. And so this hits on all these general issues regarding Hong Kong, its relation to China, sovereignty, the deterioration of democracy, democratic freedoms. For example, 5 years ago in the Umbrella Movement, the demand was for universal suffrage. That was a phrase that, you know, genuine universal suffrage, to have the ability to vote, not have that taken away by Beijing in some form. Current calls revolve around the withdrawal of this extradition treaty, which has already been suspended, but you know, the full withdrawal of it, for the chief executive of Hong Kong, the leader of Hong Kong, to resign, and for accountability for police violence that took place last week. And so those are like kind of the three main demands. But I think also there's this general call for renegotiation of Hong Kong's relation to Beijing, but people don't really have a clear thought out alternative to that. You know, people are not, I think in most cases, they're not explicitly demanding independence, for example, though that has become an issue in the past few years that's flared up.
Given the relative sizes of Hong Kong and China, it's hard to imagine a way in which China would not have an enormous influence over Hong Kong.
Exactly, and I think that's also true of Taiwan, for example, just that China and also other countries that are independent, that just China will always be around, and it will always be a large economic force, a political force, a military force. And so what then, under what auspices do you try to secure a different relation to China when it is still going to be the elephant in the room in the region, no matter what happens? I mean, the other one is, of course, the United States, despite not being part of Asia.
Well, yes, the United States is part of everyone, right?
That's right.
But has the United States have any relevance to what's going on in Hong Kong now?
I think the Trump administration does sometimes, you know, use it as a wedge issue, particularly with the U.S.-China trade war. It's a war, as a way to score points against China by pointing to these, you know, democracy activists and so forth. And sometimes, you know, I think among the democracy activists, you do have this kind of idealized image of America. Sometimes you do have these appeals to America to condemn Hong Kong or intervene. Also appeals to the British, actually, because, you know, that was the former colonizer. And, you know, now China's viewed maybe as the present colonizer. And so you idealize the previous colonizer because the current one seems worse. Do they have that? But I think that just, you know, the U.S. doesn't really have beyond role beyond just, you know, criticizing China on human rights grounds or that kind of thing, which is kind of ridiculous coming from the Trump administration.
Yes. Well, they specialize in the ridiculous. The pictures we're seeing of these demonstrators in the streets are really, really impressive. I mean, just enormous numbers. But actually, Hong Kong is no stranger to large-scale demonstrations, right? There have been several instances over the last decade, right?
That's right. And so the current demonstrations are thought of as the largest demonstrations in Hong Kong history that, you know, on Sunday, around 2 million came out to the streets, which is like 30% of the population. And so there's that. But and the week before that, just the last Sunday, or the Sunday before last, there was 1 million in the streets. And so the demonstration effectively doubled. And that is also just incredible amount of people. But before that, you have the, it's around 79 days, if I recall, the occupation of just the different districts in Hong Kong, the streets, that's referred to as the Umbrella Movement in 2014. And then you, before that, you also have the original Occupy Central, which is like the district, business district of Hong Kong, around the time of the other Occupy movements in, across the world. And then the, maybe the largest set of protests before that was probably the 2003 protests against, you know, the attempt to pass Article 23, which is criminalizing dissent against the government, which is also, you know, that's similar to the extradition law in terms of what its effect would have thought of been, to have been.
I'm speaking with Brian Hugh, an editor with New Bloom magazine. The latest round of demonstrations looks to be pretty leaderless, right? It's rather spontaneous, social media organized.
That is a claim, but I think that as with a lot of so-called, you know, structureless movements, including Occupy Wall Street, there's probably some leadership behind it. It's just that I think the movements, it's not too clear who a lot of the leaders are. I mean, it is the kind of traditional people organizing a lot of these, you know, pro-democracy demonstrations that have called for these major rallies on the past two Sundays, which brought out 1 million and then 2 million people. And so though you can consider them, I guess, as leaders in some form, but a lot of the kind of spontaneous protests that I've been pointed to are organized by young people, for example, operating through Telegram groups or, you know, just these kind of channels in which they're really trying to keep their identities anonymous. Because I think particularly in the 5 years since the Umbrella Movement, digital surveillance technology has advanced a great deal in China, and facial recognition technology and so forth. And so people are really trying to keep their identity secret. And so sometimes you'll just hear about an event happening and people show up there, you'll have these kind of, you know, spontaneously organized things taking place. I just still do think that some people are, you know, sort of leaders in some way of the so-called structuralist movement. But, you know, it's not very clear to me who they are. So a lot of what I had seen on the ground in Hong Kong does suggest to me that a lot of people did have experience in the Umbrella Movement in terms of how they reacted to police. They reacted very fast, knowing what to do in order to react to tear gas, for example, or just when the police come in with batons and that kind of thing. Like, there's this kind of experience which has definitely been passed down. They're definitely not total newcomers to social movements.
But they do seem to have a lot in common with, you know, other things like the Arab Spring or, you know, Occupy, that in the sense that they're loose, not organized, don't have any clear agenda or aims. Will it be able to, you know, translate this to any kind of longer-term movement with actual goals and gains?
And that's the thing I'm wondering, too, because I think that that is true, that, you know, it's very structureless and things do happen, a lot of self-organized actions. And so you have, like, different demographics organizing actions, like, you know, mothers, for example, or church groups or political parties or just, you know, small groupings of young people. But I think that is a question to me. I think that just based on the pattern from the last 2 weeks, you have like a major demonstration on Sunday called for by the Civil Human Rights Front, and then you have this kind of different spontaneous actions occurring throughout the weekday from these kind of smaller, mostly, you know, anonymous young people that are operating through the internet and loosely organized, loosely connected in that way. And so they take the more extreme actions, the more radical actions, and then you have this kind of big march, which is a more kind of umbrella, big umbrella movement in which, you know, a lot of different groups will show up, but not each of them, not everyone will take direct action in that way. And so I think that might actually become the pattern going forward until something shifts on the part of the Hong Kong government.
What about the political sentiments of the people in the streets? Do they fall along any traditional left-right lines, any ideology that someone might recognize, or is it just amorphous and floating?
I think it is kind of amorphous and floating. I mean, the political divide or the political cleavage in Hong Kong is between the pan-democratic camp and the pro-Beijing camp. The pro-Beijing camp is, as the name implies, they're more friendly towards China. They're pro-China, advancing Chinese policy in Hong Kong. And the pan-democratic camp calls for democracy. But they're also kind of fragmented, and there's a kind of generational split between younger people and older people, in which a lot of the younger people can't deal with the kind of the decades of infighting that have occurred within the pan-democratic camp and the kind of disorganization and so forth, and the kind of impetus of this kind of electoral politics within the Hong Kong Legislative Council. But I think just that there's this kind of amorphousness in the protesters because, you know, it is people that are against this bill. But, you know, these people are not always the most active. I mean, just 2 million people, but not all these people are organizers or active, and kind of no coherent ideology has emerged from that. And I think a lot of young people do tend to be more, you know, let's say at least center-left because of just, you know, being more progressive on or on social issues. But in terms of, like, left-right ideologies, I mean, not explicitly, let's say, left-wing or right-wing, you do have the radical elements of these protests or people that are kind of calling for the critique of these protests or calling them to be more oriented towards, you know, pointing out these economic issues and so forth. But that is definitely not the dominant voice so far.
The chief executive, Carrie Lam, is being blamed for bungling the handling of this extradition bill. How much freedom of movement does she have, or is she told to do by what to do by Chinese?
I think at the end of the day, she is told what to do by China. For example, you know, a lot of the calls are for her to resign, and a lot of people, a lot of analysts take the view currently that even if she wanted to resign right now, China would not let her resign because of the fact that if she resigns so fast, it's viewed as caving in to the demonstrators, and then that, you know, might embolden people to take more action with the view that this could secure more concessions from China. At the same time, you know, I think China's sort of trying to push the blame for her, for the bill, the extradition bill, onto her by claiming that, you know, she went ahead with this, that she didn't actually seek Chinese approval before pushing this, she got overeager and so forth. I don't know if that's true or not, but that's a narrative that seems to be emerging with Beijing trying to distance itself from her. But it's kind of remarkable because she is actually just not actually very good at her job, or she united a lot of the warring factions of the pro-democracy camp in a very strange way, just being a bureaucratic and a career bureaucrat, not a politician that is able to communicate with the public in any way, even as a pro-Beijing politician, and inflaming the public in this way.
How is that chief executive chosen?
It's voting by a 1,200-member election council. So Hong Kong doesn't actually have direct voting by the people. And so it's kind of this kind of small set of elections chosen by this committee, a lot of which, you know, there some of them are legislators, but some also are just kind of representative of business interests. And it does skew towards being pro-Beijing. And so I think that is also one of the issues regarding electoral politics in Hong Kong, that the pan-democratic camp, for example, has put a lot of energy into this. But it is, you know, the dead end because the system is so rigged. It's not direct voting. You know, you have these functional constituencies. The leader of Hong Kong is not even directly elected by the people. And so it is, you know, despite this claim that to defend democracy, it has always been a sham democracy.
And how is Beijing taking these demonstrations?
And actually, that's the thing that really surprises, that they did seem to realize that something had gone terribly wrong. And so for now, it seems like they're backing away in the sense of throwing Carrie Lam, the chief executive, under the bus and trying to distance themselves from this bill. It's viewed as a defeat for Xi Jinping in that way, the Chinese president. what then for Xi, because he is actually just pushing a hardline policy regarding anything that he, anything that China, any place that China views as a separatist territory, whether Xinjiang, Tibet, Hong Kong, or Taiwan. And so to have this big defeat in Hong Kong, which is under Chinese control, is actually quite major. It could just be that he has other things on his plate. I think the U.S.-China trade war does take precedence. At the same time, people point to the fact that this is a blow to his credibility. It is still possible, though, I feel like, that at the end of the day, if Beijing doesn't concede on this bill and protests just continue and escalate, eventually China might decide to send in troops. And that's still a possibility, I think, is not out of the question. And so it's also something I'm very worried of. You always have these rumors that the PLA, the People's Liberation Army, will come in and just, you know, put down the protesters by force. You know, there's actually laws passed within Hong Kong in the past few years which would seemingly allow for this to be legal, that you could actually allow for the legal deployment of the PLA in Hong Kong. And there were rumors during the Umbrella Movement 5 years ago that the PLA would come in and just put down the protests, but, you know, those were just internet rumors. This time, I'm not so sure, particularly given how hardline China has become in the last 5 years since the Umbrella Movement. It does seem like a more real possibility.
Well, it'd be ironic, as we're just commemorating the 30th anniversary of Tiananmen Square.
Exactly. And I think that's also one of the reasons why people keep thinking about this possibility. Could China become another Tiananmen Square? And if it does, with, you know, these like 2 million protests in the streets, it could just be even more bloody. You know, Tiananmen Square, the exact death count is unknown, but 2 million in the streets, that could be a disaster.
Yeah. Now, of course, Xi Jinping is trying to install himself as one of the great leaders, or position himself as one of the great leaders in Chinese history. So he must feel a certain bruising to his ego at this point.
Mm. And that's also one of the dangers, that Xi Jinping has removed the term limit on Chinese presidents, that, you know, in theory he could rule forever now, and similar to, let's say, Mao or Deng or whoever, but he hasn't actually done that yet. He hasn't secured lifetime rule, though it is now legally possible for him to have that. So he needs a crisis, I think, to justify as to why he should have lifetime rule. And, you know, one of the ways is to, for example, point at Hong Kong. It's a disaster, and so you need to send troops in and put it down, and there will be probably bloody resistance. And then, you know, that creates a crisis which he can use to justify lifetime rule. Another possibility, actually, that's been floated is that he attacks Taiwan, in which, you know, estimates are he would lose hundreds of thousands of troops, you know, wiping out all these Chinese young people. But then he has a crisis he needs to justify lifetime rule. And so with a centralization of power in the hands of one person, you don't know what will happen, because, you know, that person might think in their own interests rather than, you know, the country's, how to consolidate their own power.
And these demonstrations in Hong Kong, are they going to give the Chinese population any ideas?
It's a good question, because the question is really how much information about this is getting into China. You hear plenty of anecdotal accounts of people in China that just don't know about the protests, or they think that they were created by foreign elements that infiltrated Hong Kong society and stirred up, you know, separatist sentiments and so forth, that is made by the CIA, that it's a color revolution or what have you. But also, it is true that based on some of the search engine activity, people in China seem to be finding out about it, and they're, you know, trying to know what to, they're looking into what's going on. I think your average everyday person might not actually care too much, but, you know, people that are maybe more in tune to global events beyond just what is within the confines of the Great Firewall probably do know what's going on. There's actually a funny incident where the editor-in-chief of the Global Times posted about what's going on in Hong Kong, despite the fact that currently it's banned as a search term to look up, you know, what's going on in Hong Kong. And so he posted on his, I think, Weibo, condemning the events. And then people start commenting on that post, you know, just discussing the event, like, oh, well, this is the only official place in which any government person has a knowledge of this, and so I guess it's okay to discuss it here.
And finally, you were just in Hong Kong. You're in London now, but were just in Hong Kong. So
yeah,
what did it look like on the streets? What did it feel like? What did people you talked to, what were they saying?
I thought it was quite remarkable, just because, you know, I mean, I don't always buy this narrative of a completely structureless movement, but just things happen very quickly. I think in any occupation-style movement, you have just a lot of, you know, people helping each other out and things like that. You know, whenever people spot someone without goggles or a surgical mask or an umbrella to defend against tear gas, you know, people just hand them out to people. And I think a lot of young people are just kind of actually, they're pretty in it. I mean, they're doing all this just with a lot of risk at stake. They don't know if this will compromise their futures. And they're still there, and they're just staying out entire nights. And you know, sometimes it is kind of astounding to just witness this kind of bravery. And just seeing that many people kind of turn out consistently across several weeks, that is also remarkable. I think particularly just, you know, I'm used to seeing a lot of protests peter out quite quickly. And I think that really affects the sense of desperation in Hong Kong, that there's a sense of ending, you know, that if there's no, if people don't stand up for Hong Kong now, it's all over. But at the same time, I think that is I've seen quite a lot of inspiring things because of that.
That was Brian Hugh, an editor with New Bloom, an online magazine featuring radical perspectives on Taiwan and the Asia-Pacific region. You can find it at newbloommag.net. You're listening to KPFA and KPFB in Berkeley, KFCF in Fresno, and on the web to kpfa.org. My name is Doug Henwood, and the program is Behind the News. Back after a musical break. Some of the fourth movement of Haydn's String Quartet No. 64, performed by the Kodai Quartet. Next, climate grief. I know how bad things are, but I often find myself turning away from news about the permafrost melting 70 years ahead of schedule, or the inevitability of much of my hometown being underwater sometime in the next few decades. The strength of my defenses was brought home to me when I was researching my piece in the Democratic Socialists of America for the New Republic. I asked one person, who's in her early 30s, what she thought DSA's long-term strategy should be, and she replied by saying she didn't think there was a long-term. I was shocked by her answer. I grew up thinking young people should be full of hope and plans, but many now are not. It's a paradox that doing politics requires a minimum degree of hope, but it's hard to summon hope around climate. Not only are things well along the road to perdition, we have cretins like Trump and company actively speeding up the journey. How should we think about all this? The writer and climate activist Ashley Sanders spends a lot of time on this topic. She was on this program in April to talk about Extinction Rebellion, the direct action group that's doing its best to make people think seriously about the climate crisis. Here she is to talk about the psychology around that issue. Ashley Sanders.
My attitude towards climate is somewhat like reminiscent of what John Maynard Keynes said in The General Theory. He's talking about people undertaking various business enterprises and the risk of failure, but you don't want to think about that. He said you put those thoughts aside as a healthy man puts aside the expectation of death. And that's kind of how I feel a lot about climate. It's just like I know it's the news is really, really terrible, but I just kind of don't want to think about it because one wants to get on with one's day-to-day life. So how to cope with this without being so totally overwhelmed?
Yeah, absolutely. I really like that quote. I'd never heard that before. I think that for a lot of decades now, since the beginning of the climate crisis, the general kind of consensus has been, well, we just need to get people more information. And the more information we get them about how bad the world is going to be, the more they'll get on board and actually fight to stop it. But after decades, we've seen that that hasn't actually worked very well. And a lot of psychologists, activists, and other kinds of thinkers are kind of trying to say, actually, there's a huge emotional impact of fully confronting the uncertainty and violence of climate change and the uncertainty of the future. And maybe people aren't listening because they put up their defenses emotionally so they don't have to process this stuff. So how can we actually talk to people at the level that this hits them at, which is an emotional and psychological level, and help them feel like these thoughts are thinkable without, you know, perishing from stress or anxiety, and then use that to link them to broader struggles to secure climate justice. So I think a big thing is that if you start to think about climate, you feel like you're going to be alone in it. It's going to be too big, and it'll just be like a sublime that will melt your brain, and then you'll just be the downer at parties who just always wants to talk about the end of the world. So I think the key is finding structural ways to talk about this fear that climate elicits in people and help them work through it and connect them to meaningful opportunities to create change in collective groups.
But that thing looked like a ghoul like Mike Pompeo, who sees the Arctic ice melting and then sees a greater opportunity to drill for oil. We're just confronted by such not merely indifference or ignorance, but just, you know, active evil on the part of these characters that I just feel powerless to respond to something like that.
Right. I think it's really easy to feel powerless. And then when the clock is ticking, it's even more easy to feel powerless and terrified. And we are up against people who are in profound denial and who are profoundly committed to squeezing the last dollars out of a dying, energy empire. And so I think that is a really tricky thing. But a lot of people talk about how, a lot of people are studying now the difference between taking individual action and, for example, trying to be pure, like, oh, there are plastics in the ocean, so I can never use plastic bags, versus like, actually the way it improves your mental health to be part of a group of people who are working for structural change. And so I'm not saying it's just a feel good measure and you'll feel better, so that's why you should do it. But I think that the more people we have trying to talk in a structural way and refusing to take the blame for this entire destruction of the world on themselves, and instead taking it on themselves in groups to change the power structures that created this problem, I think the more you'll see change. And also I think psychologically, the more you'll feel like you have at least some power, even in a world where people are fighting really hard against anybody like us having any kind of power.
I read a piece of news like I saw the other day that the permafrost is melting like 70 years ahead of schedule. And you just like throw up your hands and say there's nothing to be done. But political activity requires some degree of hope, that the socialist tradition that formed me intellectually and politically was all about building some kind of utopia on Earth. It was an act of collective hope. It's really hard to summon any hope around this. How do you do it?
Yeah, I think it is really hard. And honestly, I think basically hope has been weaponized in this conversation by both people who are continuing to destroy the world and using their power to do that, but also by people in the environmental movement who have basically not wanted to confront people with the full impact of climate change and have basically argued to kind of keep people from the truth in order to get them active. And I understand that to an extent, but I think it's also kept us from ringing the alarm bells the way that we have needed to, and to get to a better place than we're at now. So I actually think that it's powerful to embrace despair on a personal level and to kind of try to get comfortable with that and actually feel that. Like, there are people who talk about, who write about climate grief, who talk about how at the beginning of every day they take 10 minutes and they actually meditate on the end of the world, or they meditate on extinction, or they meditate on their own death. And I doubt that a lot of people are going to be like, hey, that's a great way to start my morning. I'm gonna it's a heavy thing, but I think that actually what it requires is for our culture that is basically obsessed with not thinking about death and not thinking about any kind of finite resources to actually like sit in this and think about the fact that there is damage done and that we are confronting the end of the world, and that is heavy, and we need to actually make space for that in our lives. But then I also think that there is a power that comes out of knowing how bad the problem actually is. And I think that that motivates people, or can motivate people, to take dramatic action that they might not have taken. We've seen that with student strikes for climate, and we've seen that with Extinction Rebellion, and more people, regular people getting involved. And I think people are finally feeling this and willing to take more brave action than they have. But people also talk about, like, there are ways, and this is not something, it's hard for me to even say this because I want people to do stuff and to get involved, but there are ways in which it is too late. And what we need to focus on is really basic, hefty cultural work of changing our stories about what humans are and what they're worth amongst all these other species, and what kinds of like myths and values and stories and other things we want to found a new world on. So I think in some ways, the despair and the reality of our situation can be incredibly depressing, but it can also be fertile ground for saying being part of that socialist tradition you were talking about, and saying we need to change structures and cultural norms and stories and everything to create a world that we actually want to see out of this world that we desperately want to see be over, the evil parts of this world that we want to see end.
In this piece you've got forthcoming in The Believer, you write about a friend of yours, but you also shared some of this yourself, of developing this attitude in the face of ecological catastrophe and extreme asceticism and denial. I mean, this guy was eating only fallen fruit and things like that because he wanted to have as little impact as possible on the earth. This extreme asceticism withdrawal from an awful lot of aspects of human society. There are two aspects of this that are kind of interesting. One, I mean, there's a certain activist personality that is that way, not just about environmental things, but like, if I don't go to X event, then the world is going to come to an end. I mean, when I got married in 2002, we invited a friend who, even though this was months in advance, knew he was going to have to go speak at an anti-war rally, you know, 4 months hence in Buffalo. And, you know, that kind of attitude of like, if you don't do everything now, everything's going to fall apart. How do you deal with that kind of psychology of like not ruining yourself because of your dedication to the cause?
Yeah, I think that's such a good question. And in my experience, you know, thinking about climate grief for myself, interviewing other people, I've kind of come to feel that purity is a reaction to, is one of the only ways you can find control when you feel powerless. And so in a society that is working as hard as it can in so many ways, not just in climate and environmental ways, but in so many ways to make people feel powerless, and also the powers that be convincing so many of us that these problems are just our individual faults, then purity can be a really beguiling solution to, you know, or intense asceticism, or, you know, showing up 100% of the time. That can, it can be really easy to feel when you have no power, that maybe if you did every single thing right and you didn't participate in harm in any way, then the world would change. And I think I can definitely understand why that's so tempting. And I think also it reminds me of these conversations that a lot of people are having around these issues and other social justice issues about moral injury. And they talk about the idea that, you know, there's great violence in our world and that is harmful for people and it traumatizes people. And if you're harmed, you can have PTSD, for example. But it also requires so many of us to be in situations and to do things that we find morally objectionable because we're caught in the system. And so there's another kind of trauma that comes with being complicit in causing violence and pain in the world. And I think that purity is also kind of a response that comes out of that. Like, I don't want to be part of any of this violence, so I'm going to try to be as aesthetic as possible, as good as possible, as active as possible. But I think, you know, an important way to do this, and this is not something I've figured out for myself yet, I vacillate between these kind of extremes all the time, but is to try to figure out how to accept certain parts of your own powerlessness so that you don't have to control every single thing. And that's, I think, why people meditate a lot on the death of the world or just plain meditate. And then try to also get involved in groups that are doing bigger, more leveraging things so that you can spend the majority of your time actually trying to change the structures that require us to commit so much violence, you know, in our daily lives. Like, I talked to an activist friend and she said, by the time I get coffee in the morning, I feel like I've stepped over 1,000 skulls. And I think a lot of people feel this way at this point. And so how do you take time to actually recognize that that's how you're feeling and that you feel moral injury for that, but then to not get so caught up in that that you actually can't give your time to changing the rules that so that we can all act more sane in the future?
I'm speaking with the writer and climate activist Ashley Sanders. This also sounds somewhat like extreme psychological distress that, you know, conventionally you'd want to diagnose as mental illness. I mean, this sense of grandiosity that your cup of coffee is going to kill 1,000 people, or that this withdrawal, this asceticism, often sounds like depression and withdrawal from the world is almost psychotic. So how do we separate what seems like episodes of mental illness from an evaluation of what the future really looks like?
Right, right. And I think it's in a lot of the stuff that I research and write about is that anytime there's been a huge shift in the world, especially huge shifts towards greater violence, whether that's colonization or the, you know, beginning of the transatlantic slave trade or whatever, that dramatically changes people's lives for the worse, then you have a lot of things that show up that are diagnosed as illnesses that are actually reactions to the violence of the world or the newness or change in the world, even on a dramatic scale. So, for example, in the 21st century, we think of nostalgia as, for example, like a kitschy longing for like memories from your childhood. But in like the 16th and 17th centuries, nostalgia was actually a diagnosed disease. You could die of it. And it was an intense longing for home that was basically produced by the early, you know, early moments of globalization and the expanding idea of what the world was. And, you know, soldiers who were far away from home fighting in basically colonialist wars, or people who were taken to the Americas as slaves or, you know, whatever it was, they started to develop these profound psychological and physical responses to being taken from their home and also from being involved in these kinds of violence. And I think that illness is one way that we talk about how people respond to dramatic cultural and political shifts in order to not have to talk about the things that are actually sociopathic or psychopathic or violent. And so there's that kind of old adage of like, is the person sick or is the culture sick? So I think we can recognize the ways that living in this world and trying to respond to it, trying to respond to the violence of it can show up in really unhealthy ways for people and make them sick. But I also think it's equally important to think about the sickness of the society that is making the person respond in those extreme ways in order to just be basically decent. So I think it's a really tricky balance, but I think we have to recognize both in that conversation.
Yeah, I often wonder why it seems depression seems ubiquitous, especially among younger people now, in ways that I don't remember when I was young. Rather a long time ago, that so many people are on antidepressants, and it's almost always looked at as an individual issue or as a medical issue, but the social dimensions of it are never really looked at. In fact, you know, the antidepressants can mask the social roots of this kind of mental disturbance. This ubiquity of depression, how do you think the climate issue fits into that?
Yeah, that's interesting. In my research, I talked to a man who calls himself a dissident psychiatrist. He doesn't really believe in his own profession, and yet he's in it. But he's trying to talk more about the social conditions that create mental illness or mental health issues. And he talks about when the term shell shock was coined, and then after the Vietnam War. So shell shock originally was, you know, basically a way to describe PTSD after World War One and Two, and then after the Vietnam War, we used terms like PTSD. And his thing is like, why don't we call things what they are? Why don't we call PTSD in the Vietnam context being f***ed up by war? That would help us isolate, you know, what cultural phenomenon is causing this mass physical and psychological reaction. And then it could help us actually train our sights on fixing that rather than shaming the patient and making them feel like it's their fault and something they have to get over. And I think that's true with the climate, too. And with depression and anxiety, I think it's interesting because a lot of times people say depression is a mental response to the past. It's kind of past focus, like ruminating over things you've done and mistakes you've made. And anxiety is kind of an obsession with the future and ruminating about the future. And I think climate change brings up both in us, you know, like what have we done in the past as a society that has created these conditions that we regret now that then is giving us massive anxiety about the future and honestly whether or not we will have one. Like if you put people in a situation that, you know, economically with neoliberalism, like all the things that have led up to what millennials are dealing with now in terms of job crises and student debt and things like that. And then you add on the idea that you don't even know if you're going to have a future because of mistakes that your parents and grandparents made. That is a hefty thing to deal with. And I think, you know, everybody wants to say, oh, this is why everybody is depressed. This is why. But I don't see how you could put that saddle, you know, young people with that and not see huge incidents and spikes in depression and anxiety.
And just as we come up with individual explanations of why people are depressed or anxious, we also are prescribing very individualized cures for ecological crisis. So recycle or replace all your conventional light bulbs with LEDs or, you know, walk rather than taking a car. But that's really not adequate, is it?
No, not at all. And it's funny because I started, you know, writing about climate grief because I had it and I was trying to find a therapist who would talk to me about it. And I went through so many different people and they're like, why are you here? And I said, I feel massive anxiety about the potential end of the world. And they would just blink at me wide-eyed and they'd be like, well, have you been through a breakup recently? Or, you know, how's your work life? And I'm like, no, that's not what I want to talk about. I want to talk about this other thing. And I think that the psychological profession is like woefully underprepared and unequipped to look at not just the whole patient, but the whole person and an entire society. And so I think as a result, result, then they're only, for many people, their only tools or the only thing they know how to do is to help the person basically fit in the world that they exist in and have to exist in, rather than trying to help the person actually change the world that they live in so that they can be healthy. So there's a new branch of psychology that's kind of designed to deal with eco-anxiety and climate grief and all these kinds of huge unsettling things that cause people anxiety and depression. And it's called eco-psychology, and the kind of moniker of the founder, or the kind of motto that he had was like, psychology is if the whole earth matters. And I think that that's the kind of approach that psychological and medical institutions are going to have to take if they're going to deal with and be able to properly identify and treat people who are experiencing this. They're going to have to basically like practice a more political or politicized medicine and healing. And which to me means just recognizing that a person does not exist alone atomically in the world, that they exist in a world that is deeply violent and bent on basically total destruction, and that that makes a lot of people really upset. And before we do that, I don't think we'll be able to treat people the way that they need to be.
And turning to an issue you've also written about, birth strike. And this is something that the right uses as an argument against any concern for climate changes. You know, they're trying to take away your hamburgers, they're trying to take away your babies. And does seem, you know, I had a child late in life. I was 53 when my kid was born. So I never was one of those people who really wanted a child for much of my life, but it seems pretty widespread that people want children. This call to think twice about having one, or perhaps not have one, is, you can understand how the right could make hay with this as propaganda. So you tell us about your thinking about not wanting to have a child.
It's interesting because I grew up Mormon, and I grew up in a culture that was very, very obsessed with having children. That was basically my destiny, was to get married and have children. And I didn't want to for other kind of social justice reasons. I didn't feel like as a woman that should be my only option or my destiny in the world. And that really irked me, and that didn't sit well with me. And there were lots of other reasons why I didn't want or choose to have kids. But as I got older and started thinking about the actual future of the planet and what kind of world we were creating for the future generations, I started to think pretty hard about whether or not to have a kid. And I had one child, and after my first child, I decided that I wasn't going to have any more. And, you know, there's this birth strike movement that has grown up. The actual birth strike movement is very explicit about, like, they're not trying to tell people what to do. They're trying to create a space for people to have these conversations about whether or not to have kids, or if how to have kids, or what that conversation could look like in a world that is so uncertain. And people have a lot of different reasons for deciding not to have kids. Some people feel really afraid of the world that they're going to bring their kid into and the kind of pain that they're going to bring their kid into. You know, with people telling us that by 2050, human civilization as we know it could begin to collapse. And then there are people who are saying, well, my kid, especially if you're living in North America and you're a white, wealthy person like myself, or I'm not wealthy, but, you know, a middle-class person, like the impact that that kid will have in terms of emissions is something that you really need to think about on an ethical level, and in terms of human survival. And then for me, though, I feel both of those two first things, but I also feel really deeply that human beings have chosen, like, one reason that we are in this mess in the first place is that we have chosen to see ourselves as an exceptional species that has no obligation even to poorer members of our own species or more marginalized, vulnerable members of our own species, but certainly not to other animals that share the planet with us. And I think that one thing that has to change, like I said before, if we want to get out of the climate crisis, is not just creating renewable energy options and other things like that, but fundamentally changing our stories about what we deserve and how we should treat other beings. And for me, it's a lot about, like, we have taken over the world and the planet, and we are causing a crisis for our own, for the human race, but also we are causing a crisis for all these other animals and beings that didn't choose this. And I feel like I feel wrong about that. And so that's my personal reason for choosing not to have a child, is to try to change, you know, like, to try to basically take up as little space as possible on this planet so other people and other beings can live their lives in a way that isn't as harmed. And I know that that one decision is not going to change the course of human history, but I think if we have larger conversations about these kinds of issues and the ethics that climate change begs and the kinds of lives that we should be living and how we should treat other beings, I think that we need to have those conversations to shift the culture if we're going to survive whatever's coming in the next several decades.
I first got to know you through your activism in Extinction Rebellion, and that kind of activism is, do you find it a kind of therapy, like a way of dealing with his grief by acting out in radical ways to try to, you know, draw attention and make people do things to address this profound crisis? What does it do to you personally, but also do you and your colleagues in Extinction Rebellion talk about these things?
Yeah, absolutely. For me, I think it is very profound. I think that the majority of my time, even, you know, though I do activism and organizing, I spend a good chunk of every day feeling powerless and a lot of despair about the world. And I think when you can actually go and meet with other people face to face and say, I'm not the only one feeling this way. There are so many people feeling this way. And actually, if there are this many people, we might be more powerful than we imagine. And then to go and use, you know, your bodies or your brains or your skills to actually disrupt the, you know, forward march of a destructive world, and to actually see, like, oh, when we all join our bodies together, we have so much more power than we thought. To me, that is like a necessary part of my life, because without it, I feel like I wallow in despair and I become very cynical. And I think that cynicism is the currency that the powerful use to buy more of a destructive future that they don't deserve. And so it's kind of an attempt for me to not fall into cynicism and to remember that we have more power than we think. I think that people in power are very successful and have been very successful at dividing us along race and class and gender lines, but also just dividing us into individual people so that we feel like whatever we're experiencing, we experience in isolation, and that we can't do anything about it besides, you know, like you said, recycling or walking or whatever. And I think it's a very radical act and a very therapeutic act, a demanding therapeutic act, but nevertheless therapeutic, to actually stand up and stand with other people and believe that you could use your collective power to change the structures of the world.
I was the writer and climate activist Ashley Sanders. You can find her on the web at ashsanders.com. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. Let's go out with this, a bit of perky gloom from the legendary Pink Dots, Lisa's Party. Till next week, bye.
Trampolinist jumped too high, came crashing to the ground, but Lisa's party, Lisa's party, insisted with, but Lisa was the perfect hostess. A big surprise, spread the cyanide in layers across a delicate mince pies. Told her guests a hint of almond makes the dullest.